Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. First thing tomorrow morning, jurors will return to the Moakley Federal Courthouse in South Boston for the start of the penalty phase of the trial of Jahar Tsarnaev.
2 weeks ago, the same jury convicted Tsarnaev on all 30 counts relating to the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. 17 counts carry the possibility of the death penalty, a punishment that some victims of the bombing have asked the government to take off the table.
And joining us now to preview the penalty phase of this trial is Daniel Medwed. He's a law professor at Northeastern University. And Daniel, thanks for coming back. It's good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with that news. Some of the victims talking about the possibility of taking the death penalty off the table. On Friday, we know that Bill and Denise Richard, the parents of 8-year-old Martin Richard, who was killed at the finish line, called for just that. Yesterday, Jessica Kensky and Patrick Downs, the newlyweds who each lost a leg in the bombing, called for the same thing. What influence do these kinds of statements from the victims have on the case?
Gosh, well, I think we should look at it in terms of three different levels, Anthony. It's legal impact, practical impact, and strategic impact. So let me take each of those in turn. First, in terms of its legal impact, I do not foresee much of an effect because victims' opinions on the propriety of the death penalty have been ruled inadmissible by the U.S. Supreme Court. They're considered too distracting, confusing, and emotionally fraught. Victims may testify about the impact of the crimes on their lives, but not stray into the realm of opinion. Second, in terms of its practical impact, I do not envision that Carmen Ortiz and Eric Holder all of a sudden will reverse course and offer an 11th hour plea. For one thing, there are a diversity of views in the victim community about the propriety of the punishment here, and those views were presumably taken into account at the front end when Carmen Ortiz consulted with victims and filed a recommendation with the Department of Justice in Washington.
Yeah. Now, on this point, I mean, it's hard to imagine the feds having come this far in pursuit of the death penalty. What would be the reason for prosecutors to relent, I guess?
Possibly it could relate to what's happened the last few days if a large number of victims, including the ones that you've mentioned, Anthony, have come forward expressing opposition to the continued pursuit of the death penalty. But other than that, because there may be many silent victims who continue to believe in the propriety of the death penalty, it may be essentially problematic. The prosecutors are in a bit of a bind here. I do think, however, it will affect their strategy at the death penalty phase.
Interesting. So explain that.
Sure. So what will happen is, well, if we look at the guilt phase, it appears as though the prosecutors did rely quite heavily on Martin Richard's horrific death. There was all of that evidence about how Jahar Tsarnaev waited 4 minutes with the backpack before he placed it behind a young boy. Martin Richard's photographs and the autopsy report figured prominently in the case. At the death penalty, given now that we know that the Richards have a preference for dropping the death penalty charges, maybe the prosecutors should consider refraining from continuing to rely on Martin Richard, that case in particular, in the pursuit of the death penalty. Not a legal question, because prosecutors may continue to pursue that avenue. Prosecutors do not formally represent victims, but I think it does pose an important moral bind or dilemma.
Really interesting. And I want to ask you about that because, you know, we did see so much, we did hear about so much footage and photos from the very bloody aspects of this terrible crime. But I want to ask you about, you know, is there a point at which the jury becomes desensitized almost to these horrific images? And is that something that the prosecution needs to keep in mind?
Absolutely, Anthony. At this point, the jury has seen and witnessed a tremendous amount of carnage in the form of video evidence, photographs, and very stark, powerful firsthand testimony. At some point, there is a risk that they may become inert. They may become accustomed to these images. It's known as jury fatigue. Mm-hmm. And the prosecutors going forward may have to keep that in mind. Everything that occurred at the guilt phase is now in play at sentencing. Tomorrow, one of the first things we may hear from Judge O'Toole in his instructions is that you jurors may consider at this phase everything you heard in the previous phase. So all that evidence will still come into play, but prosecutors have a very delicate delicate calculus going forward in terms of how much additional emotionally fraught evidence they may want to introduce. Mm.
So tell us how this works tomorrow. We call this the penalty phase of the trial. Is it conducted like a trial? I mean, in what ways is it different than a traditional trial?
These hearings are very idiosyncratic, Anthony, and they depend largely on the predilections of the individual judge. Mm. There haven't been many of them, certainly not in Massachusetts. This is just the third in recent memory. They tend to resemble a trial. You'll see opening statements. The prosecution bears the burden of proof in terms of proving aggravating factors, guilt plus something else, that these were extremely horrific crimes, essentially. And then the defense will put on its mitigation case, followed by closing arguments with, as I said, sort of relaxed evidentiary rules, especially in terms of the defense presentation. The defense will presumably receive a lot of latitude in terms of presenting its mitigation argument.
Right. So let's talk about these two strategies, and let's start with the defense there. What might the defense try to say or do here to essentially spare their client the death penalty?
Well, the overarching view here is to try to humanize Jahar Tsarnaev so that at least one juror will identify with him on some level as a human being. All you need is one juror here, Anthony. The jury must be unanimous in order to support a death sentence. If one juror disagrees with the death sentence, mm-hmm. Judge O'Toole must impose life without the possibility of parole. So they're going to try to humanize him. How do they do that? In particular, there are several mitigating factors that are included in the U.S. Code that are very pertinent to this case. One is, quote unquote, minor participant, and the second is, quote unquote, duress. Those arguments are very consistent with a theme that the defense developed at trial, namely that Jahar was a follower and the brother, Tamerlan, was the leader. So I imagine they'll try to develop that theme, perhaps through testimony from friends or family members, indicating that Tamerlan was the dominant partner in that sibling relationship.
Sure. Now, how does the prosecution counter that?
The prosecution bears the burden of proof, they're going to prove aggravating factors. So some of the factors that they will presumably focus on are that this crime was one that was these crimes were ones that were particularly cruel, heinous, and depraved, that the crimes involved substantial planning and premeditation, and that they involved at least one very vulnerable victim. So the prosecution doesn't necessarily have to counter the mitigation mm-hmm. evidence as much as it has to put on affirmative evidence that this is guilt plus. This is a particularly heinous and depraved case.
You know, I'm really curious to know what you think, and I've talked to a bunch of people in the last few months, and the thing that puzzles me about this is trying to sort of guess how this is going to work out. Because on the one hand, the crimes that Tsarnaev committed were so horrendous that it seems like if there's going to be a case for the death penalty, this would be it. On the other hand, we know that all 12 jurors have to agree in order for him to get the death penalty. So in your view, who's got the steeper hill to climb, the defense or the prosecution?
It's very difficult to predict at this stage. Yeah. I looked back at the data this morning about all the federal death penalty trials since 1988. There have been 229 death penalty trials that reached this sentencing phase. Mm. In two-thirds of them, the jury voted for life, or essentially did not choose death. And one-third, they chose death. So that's not necessarily indicative. Every case is different. But it does appear, at least statistically, like when it comes down to it, many jurors may vote for life.
Sure. So let's talk about these two possible outcomes, and I'll start with the death penalty. If the jury votes for the death penalty, what happens? I mean, what happens then?
Okay. So he presumably, no matter what, is going to end up in Supermax in Florence, a Supermax facility in Florence, Colorado, where he'll spend 23 hours a day in solitary confinement, mm-hmm. not as a punitive measure per se, but to protect himself because he's going to be a target of other inmates. Okay. If it's a death sentence, then immediately many resources will be deployed to defense lawyers to handle the appeal and so-called post-conviction or habeas process. Presumably, it will take many, many, many years for this to unfold with no certain result that he will necessarily be executed. Of the 79 federal death sentences in recent memory, only three of those folks have actually been executed so far. So if, in fact, he's ultimately executed, which is by no means a certainty, it may take many decades.
Right. Whereas if he ends up with life in prison without parole, he's in that supermax prison for the rest of his life.
Absolutely. Now, he still retains a right to appeal, but there's a risk that if he were to appeal it and get a new trial, that he might then be subject to the death penalty upon a resentencing. sentencing. Hmm. So he has a right to appeal. And depending on the facts, there may be issues where that's not in play. But the likelihood that we'll hear about this over and over again is greatly diminished if, in fact, it's an LWOP sentence, a life without possibility of parole.
So in this next penalty phase of the trial, I want to ask you this finally. Is there any chance that Jahar Tsarnaev will take the stand?
Slim to none, Anthony. There's so much to lose from the defense perspective. Mm. First of all, he does not appear, at least by all accounts of firsthand observers, to be a particularly remorseful a person. His affect hasn't played very well so far in the courtroom. At least that appears to be the case. The second reason why it might be problematic, for the defense at least, is he would then be subject to a potentially withering cross-examination mm-hmm. by the prosecutor. Can you imagine some of those questions? What were you thinking, Mr. Tsarnaev, as you waited behind that boy for 4 minutes with a bomb in your backpack? So I can't imagine that he will testify in this phase of the trial.
All right. Well, that's Daniel Medwed. He's law professor at Northeastern University, talking about the penalty phase in the trial of Jahar Tsarnaev, which begins tomorrow in federal court in South Boston. Daniel, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Time now for the latest in our occasional conversations with members of the Massachusetts Congressional Delegation. Nikki Tsongas represents Massachusetts' 3rd District, and in this, her 4th term, Democrats are the minority party in the House. So we began by asking Representative Tsongas if the atmosphere on the Hill is as acrimonious as pundits in the media make it out to be.
There is an understanding that the American people want us to resolve problems. That being said, the differences are still great, and sometimes the process is far more tortured than it should be when, in the end, the legislation that is going to pass through the House of Representatives, through the Senate, and be signed into law, because that's the bottom line, has to be bipartisan in nature.
Yeah. Well, let's move on and talk a little bit about Iran, if we could, for a moment, because President Obama has agreed to sign a bipartisan bill that emerged from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that could potentially allow Congress to vote on any nuclear agreement that's hashed out with Iran. Do you think that that is a necessary check on the executive office?
Well, I think that the President Obama has himself conceded that point. Obviously, we'll have to all closely look at what the end product is, and I think this bipartisan agreement will give Congress that opportunity. But the reality is, I think we have to remain very focused on achieving a diplomatic solution, and I think this bipartisan agreement allows those very serious discussions to go forward.
Yeah. So a couple questions about issues closer to home. First of all, I'm just wondering if you think Massachusetts should have received more federal aid when it comes to all that winter snow that we had. We didn't get as much as Governor Baker had asked for.
I certainly do wish we had received more aid. I commend our governor for making a very strong case, but we have an opportunity to appeal it and move forward, and we will all certainly work hard to do that. I recently fell and broke my finger, and people said, oh, it must have been on the snow and ice in Massachusetts. Everybody watched these storms and this weather, and were kind of just amazed at it. And I said, no, I was on the streets of sunny California for a family wedding. So I survived the snow and ice, but we obviously know it did real damage to our infrastructure and obviously imposed great costs on our communities. So we've got to work hard and hope that we can bring more funding back into Massachusetts.
The penalty phase in the trial of Jahar Tsarnaev is about to begin. One of the most impassioned discussions going on right now in Massachusetts is the question of the death penalty. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I am strongly opposed to the death penalty. We all recoil at the notion of putting someone to death. We see all too much of it in our world today. But given just the horrific nature of these actions, the impact on so many innocent lives, I feel it's not inappropriate for the jury to have this penalty to consider.
Hmm. Well, finally, there's just a couple questions about women and leadership that I'd like to get your thoughts on. As I'm sure you know, two of your fellow delegation members, Congressman Michael Capuano and Congressman Stephen Lynch, they criticized Representative Nancy Pelosi's leadership of the Democratic Party on the House side, and they called for a new approach to help Democrats get back in the majority. Do you agree with them?
Well, first of all, as the first woman in 25 years to be elected to Congress from Massachusetts in 2007, I have to say it was a distinct honor and a very memorable moment to be sworn in by then Speaker Pelosi, who had then herself shattered a glass ceiling. We know that when she was Speaker, she oversaw one of the most productive Congresses in history, one that we should all admire. And I've seen her lead in the minority, I think she's been remarkable. If you look at the recent successes in negotiating with Speaker Boehner on the ways in which we reimbursed doctors under Medicare, that was a bipartisan effort that came immediately on the heels of finding a way forward on Homeland Security, in which initially funding of Homeland Security was being held hostage to some of the immigration decisions that President Obama has put into place. So I frankly think she's a remarkable leader. I have tremendous respect for her and am certainly committed to her leadership.
So I take it that you disagree with their criticism and think that she is the right person to lead the Democrats in the minority.
I think she's been a remarkable and continues to be a remarkable leader of the institution.
Okay. So you were just at UMass Lowell talking to students about your time in Congress and leadership. In response to a student question, I read that you said, "We need more women in Congress and in politics, but we can't win if we don't run. The reality is we have the power, but the challenge is getting there." You know, as an observer of politics, one of the things that I've noted is that sometimes it seems like it's tough to run as a woman. Everyone's going to talk about Hillary's hair, regardless of what you think of her as a politician. People are going to talk about her hair. People are going to talk about what she wears. When that's the example for other young women, it's a little tough to get them to say, "I want to do that too."
No one ever suggested it was going to be simple. And I also think as a woman, you have to be very wise about it and understand some of the impediments. And fortunately, there have been a number of people and institutions out there that have given a lot of thought to that and to help us all be very mindful of where some of the landmines might be. But that being said, when we do run, we win. So if you look at Massachusetts, we've elected a woman to the United States Senate, our first, in Senator Warren. We've elected a woman to Congress in Ed Markey's old seat, Representative Clark. I think we have to look at the opportunities that we will inherit as a result of running and then hopefully winning. And I think that helps get you through.
So finally, given the time of year that we're at, possibly the most pressing question I could ask you is your prediction for the Red Sox.
Well, they're off to a good start. We have to see it through, always.
A very wise response. Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Magda. Take care.
Stay with us. Coming up on this Marathon Monday, a conversation about hips and whether they affect the way you run or not. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.